The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hi, I'm Dr. Will Cole. This podcast is the manifesto for a new breed of health seekers. This is The Art of Being Well. What's up, everyone? It's Dr. Will Cole, and welcome to The Art of Being Well. I am a leading functional medicine expert. I get to consult people around the world via webcam. I started one of the world's first functional medicine telehealth centers over a decade ago, and I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I wrote Intuitive Fasting, which is my newest book, and also Ketotarian and The Inflammation Spectrum. If you want to learn more about my clinical work, the telehealth center, or the books, and there's loads of free content there as well, you can check it all out at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. All right, let's get to today's guest. He is a good friend of mine and an esteemed colleague in functional medicine. His name is Dr. David Perlmutter. Dr. Perlmutter is a board-certified neurologist and a five-time New York Times bestselling author. He serves on the board of directors and is a fellow of the American College of Nutrition. His books, you may have heard of them, they are groundbreaking books in our field. Brainwash, Grain Brain, so many great books. Brainmaker, I could go on and on. Great stuff. And in today's conversation, we cover some very exciting things that I know you all will love. We talk about how and what actually is disconnection syndrome and why you want to know what this means, and the other factors that are linked to many brain health issues and other inflammatory health issues. We talk about applying the acronym TIME, T-I-M-E, you have to learn about this, toward better decision-making. We talk about the impact and effects of blue light on our health. We talk about the really exciting research that Dr. Perlmutter discusses in his book, Brainwash. And we talk about what Dr. Perlmutter has learned about the art of being well in his illustrious career. All right, let's get to today's conversation with my friend, Dr. David Perlmutter. My friend, Dr. Perlmutter, thanks so much for taking the time and being on the show.
It's great to see you again. I'm trying to think back when we last saw each other. It was in California, I suspect, right?
Yeah, I think it was. It probably was on for Goopfellas when we were all there.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
exactly.
I wasn't in studio for that one, but I talked to you. I was in the clinic, but yeah. And normally, I mean, under normal circumstances, we're seeing each other at least a couple times a year for different events. It's different the past year.
It's like when you fast and then you finally have dinner or break your fast, and you savor it. So I'm going to look forward to seeing you. That'll be great.
Yeah, likewise. So you're a wealth of knowledge on so many things, but I want to talk about your most recent book, Brainwash. How did the book come to be? Take me back to the early days as a writer and as a clinician of how the formulation of the book began.
The book was actually had its genesis in this exact room where I'm sitting right now. I was there's a couch over there, and my son was sitting in this chair. Mm-hmm. And he is an internal medicine MD. And we were talking about, you know, what would it take to be more effective as a doctor? And we realized that we do the best we can to learn as much information as we possibly can to offer up new ideas for our patients. We then transmit that information to our patients as best we can using whatever skill set we have. And then we hope for the best. And that's where it seems the situation breaks down. The paradigm breaks down because, you know, so often, more often than not, when we give great, and I'm sure you've experienced this for many years, you give the best information you can to the patient, they come back to see you after a couple of months, nothing's changed. Mm-hmm. They've gained weight, their insulin levels are higher, their blood sugars are higher, whatever it is that you're trying to help them with doesn't seem to be going in the right direction because they didn't follow through on the information. In other words, they didn't make the right choice. And we came to an understanding as we began to explore what is it in our brains that is so fundamental for our ability to make a good decision. What's going on in there? And that's what we decided we would approach because that's the weak link in the chain. If we can give people the mental horsepower to make better choices, to subscribe to the things that they think are going to be helpful for them, then we're going to be a heck of a lot more successful and more people are going to benefit from what we try to impart on them. So Austin and I did the deep dive into how does the brain make a decision? How do we make decisions? And it turns out that there are some pretty straightforward areas of the brain that are involved in either being impulsive and saying, I want the jelly donut right now and I'm going to have it come what may, or I want to stay up all night, or I want to take drugs or whatever you want to do or not, or I'm going to make a decision that says, you know, today I'm going to fast, or today I'm going to get more exercise, or I'm going to reach out to other people. I'll spend more time out of doors. I'll engage in meditation. All of the things that might be better for you that, again, we talk about. So it's about really how is the brain constructed to be impulsive and self-centered, or how does it make challenges, address challenges that might lead to decisions that think about long-term consequences, that think about not just how these decisions are going to affect me, but how they may affect the next person, the other person, which is called empathy, and how they may play out in the long run, long-term, more complex decision-making. We learned that certainly the brain is very complex, but there are two primary areas that are involved in decision-making. One is the amygdala, which is involved in impulsivity, which says, I want the jelly donut now, come what may. And the other is this prefrontal cortex, this area up here behind our foreheads that says, whoa, hang on a second, let's think this through. And it turns out that we can very much engage in changes in our lives, lifestyle choices that can foster better decision-making by allowing us to amplify the role of the prefrontal cortex and at the same time suppress the urges, which is really what, you know, willpower is all about. And I don't mean Will Cole power. There's a lot of power there too. Name of your next book. I think we did this once before.
I think so. I think anyway. We need to own that. We'll have to patent that.
But the important part of the revelation is that the prefrontal cortex exercises control. We call it top-down control over the more primitive reptilian brain, in this case, the impulsivity, poor decision maker, the amygdala. Not to say that the amygdala is a bad thing. We need snap decisions on occasion. You know, that's what allows you, the amygdala allows you to, for example, you're backing your car up, you see a kid in the rearview mirror or camera these days on a tricycle, you step on the brake. You don't think, well, maybe in the long run, it's a good idea. We need those types of instantaneous decisions. But to instantaneously decide, I'm going to eat this and I know it's bad for me, but heck, I'm going to go for it anyway, leads to trouble. So what I'm saying is then in the clinic, when we are seeing, for example, an overweight diabetic, it doesn't make sense always to say, okay, today, Mr. Jones, because here's your first day, we're going to set you on your path to getting better. We're going to talk about the right foods that you should be eating. It's not going to work. Mr. Jones has visited many other doctors, read the books, seen the shows, and knows darn well what he or she shouldn't eat. Might well have looked at the data with respect to becoming non-diabetic by engaging a ketogenic diet, but never even thought that he would do that. What we might do instead is think to ourselves, how can we help this patient restructure his brain such that he makes better decisions? And then in the future, we can approach him with the right dietary choices and he's in a better position to do that. Mm-hmm. It might be as simple as asking Mr. Jones, how well do you sleep? And then be prepared for the answer. Oh, I sleep great. Move on. And take it a little further. Say, well, how long do you sleep? Well, I sleep 8 hours a night. Then ask the question, well, is that good sleep? And Mr. Jones is going to say to you, well, Dr. Cole, how in the heck should I know? And it's a great question because I would ask you how you would know. And you would probably tell me, well, I have a wearable device and I know darn well how I sleep. I can tell you, I know how well I sleep. I have an Oura Ring and I wake up in the morning and it says I got 8 hours and 12 minutes of sleep. I spent 1 hour and 18 minutes in deep sleep, 2 hours in REM sleep. It took me this long to get to sleep. I had two interruptions where I actually wake, whatever. My point is that we have the technology to determine not just the length of sleep, but the quality of sleep. Mm-hmm. That's hugely important because it weighs in on the decision-making the very next day. Mm-hmm. It is one of the arbiters of determining whether you're going to make decisions from the amygdala, which will be impulsive, or you're going to bring online the prefrontal mm-hmm. cortex and decide that maybe you're not going to eat until noon. And when you do, you're going to have a salad and think about eating more good fat, all the things that we know are important for you. So these are on-ramps to better decision-making, getting more sleep, mm-hmm. getting more quality sleep, getting out into nature, re-engaging your exercise program, meditating, connecting with other people, lots of things that Austin and I, in writing Brainwash, discovered are really good hacks, if you will, to get back to better decision-making.
Today's program is brought to you by Athletic Greens, the most comprehensive daily nutritional beverage. With so many stressors in life, it's difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients it needs to thrive. Our busy schedules, poor sleep, exercise, the environment, stress, or simply not eating enough of the right foods can leave us deficient in key nutrients. This is where Athletic Greens can help. It is a life-changing nutritional habit. Their daily all-in-one superfood powder is your nutritional essential. It is by far the easiest and most delicious nutritional habit that you can add to your daily routine today and empower towards better habits for the rest of your life. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. I love it because I'm consulting patients all day long. I'm a functional medicine telehealth center. I love getting this nutrient-dense source in between consulting patients. It's so convenient and so effective and tastes delicious. Just one tasty scoop of Athletic Greens contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food source ingredients, including a multivitamin, multi-mineral, probiotic, a green superfood blend, and more that all work together synergistically to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet, increase your energy and focus, aid with digestion, and supports a healthy immune system, all without the need to take multiple products or pills. And right now, they are offering my audience a free one-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase if you visit my link today. So whether you're looking for peak performance or better health, covering your bases with Athletic Greens makes investing in your energy, immune system, gut health, each day super simple, tasty, and efficient. Simply visit athleticgreens.com/WillCole and join health experts like myself, athletes, and health-conscious go-getters around the world who make a daily commitment to their health every day. Again, simply visit athleticgreens.com/WillCole and get your free year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs today. Digestive problems are so common for so many people. I mean, things like gas, bloating, constipation, heartburn, looser stools, acid reflux. I mean, there's so many different digestive symptoms that people just settle for. Just because something's your everyday doesn't mean you should settle for it. Just because something's common doesn't necessarily mean it's normal. 70 to 80% of your immune system is in your gut. So digestive problems don't just impact your digestion. It impacts your body systemically. Hippocrates, if you remember him, the father of modern medicine, he said all health problems begin in the gut. And now research is catching up with that, that the majority of health problems today, things like autoimmune issues, metabolic issues, even brain health issues, have gut-centric components to their pathophysiology. So stomach disruption can be more than just digestive problems. The trillions of beneficial bacteria in our gut are crucial for our overall health. They break down food, teach your body how to recognize threats, and supports your optimal immune strength. Feeling your best requires that you have as much good bacteria living in your gut as possible. Unfortunately, it doesn't take much to deplete your supply. Stress levels can impact it. Just one round of antibiotics, poor food choices, exposure to chemicals like glyphosate, or a viral infection can all do a number on your gut garden, your microbiome. And that's why I'm such a big fan of Just Thrive Probiotic. I recently had Just Thrive's founder, a microbiologist, on the podcast. Definitely check out that episode. Just Thrive Probiotic is vastly different because of one word: survivability. See, most probiotics die well before they ever get to your gut. Even the supposedly special probiotics in the refrigerated section are in effect dead on arrival. This makes sense. If a probiotic can't survive at room temperature, how could it possibly survive your 98.6 degree body temperature? It just doesn't make sense. Just Thrive Probiotic is different because their proprietary strains are designed to survive. Personally, I've added Just Thrive Probiotic to my daily routine and I am loving it. I highly, highly recommend it. For exceptional gut and immune support, there's nothing like Just Thrive Probiotic. To get 15% off your order today, go to justthrivehealth.com and use promo code WillCole at checkout. Again, that's justthrivehealth.com. Use promo code WillCole at checkout for 15% off your order today.
Hi, I'm Allie Webb, the founder of Drybar.
Hey, I'm Adrian Kayla, the founder of Take New Ground.
Previously on Raising the Bar, Michael and I learned how founders moved from idea to scale. In this new season, we'll be exploring the inner world of an entrepreneur, the juicy stuff.
Pursuing a vision brings up fear and personal challenges, the stuff that nobody likes to talk about. So we dive into what it takes to overcome the obstacles that make most people quit. This is a study on perseverance.
Adrian is a coach for select executives. I love his brilliant mind and deep love for people, including me.
So if you're starting a business and already want out, tune in. You might not be as alone as you think.
Just to reiterate the things that Dr. Perlmutter just said for everybody that's listening, we all want to do healthier things in our life. So whether that is exercising more, whether that's eating a clean diet, a lot of us try and we grit our teeth and we push through something, but there's only so long that our willpower can play out. And most of the time people fail. So what you're advocating for in Brainwash is coming at this with a different perspective. And you talk about these two parts of our brain, which I love in the book, and I've heard you speak about very eloquently the difference that from an evolutionary standpoint, the difference of the amygdala versus the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, I mean, again, we need the amygdala. I'm not saying we ought to all go have our amygdalas removed and we make better decisions. We, at times, need to have quick decisions that don't, you don't want to think it through when you touch the hot stove. Even when you think, well, it's hot, my finger is sizzling, maybe I should, you know. So, but that said, I think that, you know, by and large, it's good to bring that good decision maker and calm down that five-year-old who wants just what I want and I want it now. Right. And that's what we call top-down control. We didn't invent that term. It's the top-down control from this wonderful gift we have, this prefrontal cortex, to rein in the child in the room, bring the adult back in the room, make the better decisions. And the most important thing that reduces the ability of the prefrontal cortex to exercise this top-down control is actually something you wrote a book about, the inflammation spectrum. How so pervasive is this mechanism of inflammation in all the things that we don't want to get. We don't want to get Alzheimer's, coronary artery disease, diabetes, obesity, cancer, you name it. These are inflammatory disorders. And guess what? It turns out that inflammation is playing a central role in cutting down this influence that the prefrontal cortex, the adult in the room, has on our more primitive, impulsive decision maker. So everything that we can do to reduce inflammation in terms of our dietary choices, other lifestyle choices, exercise, sleep, etc., whatever we can do to target inflammation will help us keep the adult in the room and help us make better decisions about our health, about anything in our lives. We were recently puzzled at first and then pleased to hear that Brainwash, it was published also in England, it's in 14 languages, was adopted by this group that gives information out about making financial decisions, whether you're going to buy this next stock because you read an article this morning, you're going to put some money into it, which probably doesn't work out well, or you're going to slow down a little bit. Let's look at some data and make a more informed decision, i.e. bring the prefrontal cortex on board and look, you know, recruit as much information as you can externally, but also what the prefrontal cortex does is it recruits information internally, past experiences, logs into different parts of your brain, allows you to amalgamate information from your previous experiences that you can then leverage to make a better decision today.
So what most of us have varying levels of overactivation of our amygdala, that petulant child in the room, and we're trying to rebalance that and get our prefrontal cortex being more supportive, stronger, healthier. Something you talk about in the book is this concept of disconnection syndrome, which I love how you put it, and it's a very descriptive term of what's going on. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So we created this term disconnection syndrome and it became a thing. Now it's a, you know, people are talking about
it. It's a thing.
It's a thing. And we originally rounded out the definition to really be what you and I've just talked about. And that is this disconnection of the prefrontal cortex from the amygdala. In other words, losing that top-down control. And subsequently in the book, we talk about other kind of manifestations of disconnection syndrome or other definitions of it. But let's just stay there for just one moment. And, you know, when we look around our world right now, I think we're seeing a lot of impulsive behavior. And I'm not characterizing any particular group, but I think a lot of what's going on in the world is impulsive and self-centered. That takes me back to inflammation. Through the mechanism of diet, you know, the modern Western highly processed refined carbohydrate diet, we will all agree, hopefully, is a pro-inflammatory diet. That Western diet is becoming the global diet. So that westernization of the global diet is creating higher levels of inflammation around the planet. And if inflammation is severing us from the ability to think of other people and to think long range in terms of our decision making, then the globalization of this Western diet might explain as a factor why we're seeing such nationalism globally, where our countries are becoming much more centered on their ideologies and less concerned about others, less concerned about the planet. And, you know, again, I think food is playing a big role in that. So that's the, you know, I think the reason we first came upon or created this term disconnection syndrome. But we, as we explain in the book, we can extrapolate that that term to be the disconnection that we have induced by our modern lifestyles, the disconnection we have from our DNA, that our DNA wants to express itself in such a way that it reduces inflammation, that it provides trophic chemicals for our brain, for our body, that it allows things to happen like autophagy, getting rid of defective cellular parts, that it does things to keep us alive. And it really, I guess, is sort of the fundamental there of the paleo mentality, that we've kind of gotten away from signaling our DNA in the way that it's used to being signaled. It's this environmental evolutionary disconnect, which has been talked about. That's an important part of disconnection syndrome. Yeah. We're disconnected from the life-sustaining messaging of our gut bacteria. Our gut bacteria are doing their damnedest to keep us healthy because it's in their interest. They want a nice warm place to live with lots of food that's good for them. And, you know, we disconnect from the fact that they are supportive of our lives by creating certain things, by reducing inflammation via modulating our immune systems and reinforcing the integrity of the gut lining, keeping us happy by helping create good neurochemistry, neurotransmitters, a variety of things that they do. They modulate our genome, for crying out loud. Disconnection from each other is, boy, that is front and center these days, that's for sure. And certainly the disconnection that is quite evident amongst humans from, you know, the relationship to our planet that has always been one of the fundamental issues that humans appreciated was our interrelationship with the planet that sustains us. Yeah. We seem quite distant from that relationship these days.
Yeah. One of the factors on that note, kind of touching on what you just said, one of the factors of disconnection syndrome that you talk about in the book is loneliness. And we are so hyper, quote unquote, connected in many ways with the advent of social media and the internet and technology. But you look at the statistics of loneliness and anxiety and depression from that loneliness. Can you talk about that? Why are we so connected? How can we be so connected, but yet be so lonely at the same time?
Well, we can layer that upon our current situation where we are basically being told to isolate these days. So it becomes a real challenge. Loneliness as a characteristic is powerfully associated with some of our most pervasive and pernicious disease processes like Alzheimer's and coronary artery disease and diabetes and obesity. So there's a lot that rides along this loneliness issue. And it's puzzling that, you know, we live in a country of, 340 million individuals, and yet people feel lonely. And we have this thing called social media, which, you know, the nomenclature would lead us to believe that, you know, this is a way that we socially interact with others, but it breeds loneliness because it breeds a sense of isolation and inferiority and fear. And that's what happens on our social media experiences. I'm not going to outright castigate the internet. The internet's, you know, can be a wonderful resource. My gosh. You know, to democratize knowledge the way the internet has the opportunity to do is, it's so powerful that we can share ideas and that we can move the ball down the field by interacting with other people and looking at other ideas that we may not have thought of, and even other ideas that may, you know, be counteractive towards what our goals may be. That said, we know that 42% of the time that Americans are awake, they're in front of a screen of one form or another, be it their phone, pad, television, or computer. That, you know, can be threatening when we recognize what a powerful hack occurs while we're involved in being online. How our online experiences are absolutely manipulated to captivate our attention and ultimately to captivate our decision-making such that we end up buying things and, you know, supportive of other people that, you know, our attention is really sold to the highest bidder online. I think that's pretty clear. So again, I think there's great value to the technology that we have that allows people like you and me right this minute to interact and to end up net positive when it's all said and done. So we talk about in Brainwash applying the test of time to our online experience. Time, an acronym T. How much time are you going to dedicate to what is it that you're going to do? I'm going to look up something. I'm going to reconnect with my high school friends. I'm going to spend an hour or 45 minutes with Will Cole doing a podcast today. Whatever it is, we set a timer. Either we actually set a timer on our iPhone or whatever, or an hourglass, or we do it mentally. We say, you know, I'm going to spend the next 45 minutes researching XYZ. Because what happens is while we're online, we all know this to be true, that our brains are hacked by pop-ups that tend and remarkably take us to something else that we're interested in. Well, we know how that happens. The I in the test of time is intentional. What is our intention in terms of what we are now going to go online and do? What is the goal? And do we remain focused on the intention of that goal, accomplishing that goal? In other words, M, now we've gone T-I-M, are we mindful? Is this a mindful activity or is it mindless? Allowing ourselves to be sucked down rabbit holes that, again, you know, hack into our attention because it's valuable for other people. And finally, the E in the test of time is the experience empowering? Is it net positive. When you're all said and done, you walk away from that saying, what happened to my day? What did I just do? Or I accomplished my goal. I downloaded some music that I want to learn on the piano. And now I'm not going to let this, you know, this interface take away the rest of my day. You know, it's been said that when you're doing one thing, you're not doing something else. And if 42% of our waking hours is spent in front of a screen, we're not getting outside, we're not exercising, we're not preparing our food, we're not having contact with other people. And let's be clear, when we are told to distance from people or to maintain a social separation, it doesn't mean we can't see people, we can't interact with people, we can do it very safely, we know what the constraints are, and we need to do it. It's really exceedingly important for our health, mm-hmm. our mental health, our physical health, to keep inflammation tamped down, and certainly mm-hmm. to lower our stress levels, our cortisol levels, which feeds back to amping up inflammation and locks us again into that primitive part of our brains.
Something that I'm always talking to my patients about is this bi-directional relationship between mental health and physical health. In the West, we like to separate mental health from physical health, but the reality is mental health is physical health. Our brain is part of our body, and our thoughts and emotions, our mental health impacts your physical health. It can impact our immune system, inflammation levels, our gut health, our hormones. So we have to look at both sides of the coin. As a functional medicine practitioner, I'm dealing with the physiological stuff, the underlying GI issues, hormonal problems, inflammation issues, or nutrient deficiencies that could be contributing to somebody's anxiety, depression, fatigue, other brain health issues. But conversely, we have to look at the mental emotional components to our overall wellness. So we have to ask the question, I mean, what's interfering with our happiness? Is something interfering with our happiness or our mental health? And that's why I love what BetterHelp is doing. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. What it is that I really love is that it's professional counseling done securely online. So just like I have a functional medicine telehealth center. What BetterHelp is doing is professional counseling done virtually as well. You can send a message to your counselor anytime. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without ever having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it super easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. The service is available for clients around the world. Find the particular expertise you need online. Don't limit yourself to the counselors located in your city. Licensed professional counselors who are specialized in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBTQ matters, grief, and self-esteem. Anything you share is 100% confidential, super convenient, professional, affordable, and make sure to check out all the testimonials that they post daily on their website. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/ABW. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp. H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/ABW.
On the note of screen time and technology, and people are spending more time online, even more so with work and working from home and being socially isolated maybe and depending on their technology more, can you explain blue light and the impact that can have specifically on our health?
I'd be happy to. So for those of you who wondered about the segue that Will just offered between our online experience and something called blue light, we know that our digital devices emit a high amount of blue light that we don't necessarily see. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that unique frequency of light in the entire spectrum of visible light, that unique frequency tends to degrade our ability in our brains to make an important chemical called melatonin. Melatonin we need for two important reasons. Now, you probably thought I'd first go to sleep, but I won't. Melatonin is really important for the balanced function of our immune system. Everybody talks about melatonin for sleep. Yeah, it's important. We'll get there in a moment. But I think in this time, when we are really dependent upon both our innate immune systems to be able to greet a viral exposure, for example, and deal with it, and then our adaptive immune systems to help further deal with it by creating memory T cells and also creating antibodies via our B cells. We depend upon both of those. And it turns out that melatonin influences the activity of both of those important parts of our immune system. So what I am saying is that if we don't allow our brains to amp up their melatonin production, it may have some important consequences in terms of balancing our immune systems, to the extent that now there are protocols for intervention when people have gotten COVID-19, actually giving people melatonin to help with the way that they deal with it. I would say that think about this on the front end and keep your melatonins where they need to be based upon limiting the amount of blue light exposure you get. The other obvious important consideration that does actually also play a role in immunity is how blue light affects our sleep through melatonin. Melatonin helps you ease into sleep. And when you have low levels of melatonin in the evening because the blue light from your screen is inhibiting it, then it makes sleep possibly less restorative. Less restorative sleep affects the immune system. Less restorative sleep, we talked about it earlier, increases inflammation, and that tends to lock you into the fear center, the self-centered part of the brain, the impulsive area called the amygdala. So what can you do? Well, you can take melatonin in the evening, perhaps. You can take a small dosage. People use as much as 10 milligrams. That's way too much for me. I take when I do take melatonin, I'm very sensitive to it, so I take about 1.5 milligrams to 3 milligrams, probably because my melatonin level is pretty high anyway. Or if you must, for whatever reason, be in front of a screen, you can wear blue light blocking glasses. Who knew? They're really cheap, you know, $15 on any online place you want to go shopping, and you can get glasses and you can wear while you're online, while you're watching television, block the blue light. And guess what? You're going to find that you go to sleep a lot easier. One other thing I'll mention is that there tends to be a lot of blue light in LED light bulbs. So keep that in mind because, you know, we're really, for the most part, good reason, transitioning away from incandescent light bulbs. So we're getting, you know, higher Kelvin temperature light bulbs that tend to have more blue light in them. So you might say, hey, I'm not going to watch TV in bedtime. I'm just going to, you know, lie in bed and read. Still getting some blue light if that bulb in your lamp is LED. There are a lot of upsides to LED. The bulbs last forever. They don't use, you know, they use about 1/10 the amount of electricity. Other upsides, but keep in mind, they do provide blue light. Now, blue light's a good thing in the daytime. You know, when you wake up in the morning, you need to get some blue light to shut that melatonin off, to reset your entire circadian rhythm or kind of lock it into the fact that this is daytime. And it happens when sunlight comes into your eyeballs, goes into your retinas through your optic nerve, and that tends to stimulate an area called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. That will be on the quiz that follows. And that suprachiasmatic nucleus is involved in telling you it's daytime. It's time for your brain to be doing certain things. It's time for your physiology to know that you're going to feed it nutrients. It's the time that you'll be taking in nutrition as opposed to nighttime when we really shouldn't be involved in digestion or eating food. Kind of a different story, but you know, it all relates back to being in sync with what our bodies really want to be doing in order to keep us healthy and, importantly, reduce inflammation. I mean, again, talking to you about this, you wrote the book on it, how fundamental that task is to keeping us healthy and, you know, allowing us to live a long life, but also increasing our health span so that we might live to be 80, 90, whatever it may be. But during that period of time, we can be healthy and active for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm. So sleep is, you mentioned it being impacted by the blue light. And before I talk about sleep more, I've also seen with patients over the years is from the blue light and being on their screens a lot, their eyesight is going down as well. Like they're, that's part of the problem too. Have you seen that too?
I'm not going to say specifically that I've observed that because it's kind of hard to tell. I mean,
right.
There is some amazing research that just came out last month dealing with eyesight. And maybe I'll just go there for a second because I'm still not over it. I'm Dr. David Sinclair at Harvard, you may know of him from his work with resveratrol and sirtuins and NAD. I had the opportunity to spend an hour with him yesterday. And he has a new book, actually, here you go.
It's called Lifespan. Talk about it.
I happen to have it right there. And he talks in the book about resveratrol, about longevity, caloric restriction, using NAD as a supplement, maybe taking metformin, all these things. But his latest research is really quite profound. He has utilized a technique that was created by another researcher, Dr. Yamanaka, whereby certain factors are able to revert cells back to an earlier stage in their lives. In other words, bring them back to childhood, not all the way back to being stem cells, but back to their childhood, where they already know what they want to be when they grow up. And the research he published with Dr. Liu in his lab in December was profound. They had mice models, mice, and they damaged the optic nerve. They traumatized the optic nerve, which is, you know, typically in an animal, that's the end of their vision. They applied these Yamanaka factors, three of the four Yamanaka factors, and regenerated these neurons from in the optic nerve and restored vision.
Wow.
By reverting the cells that were remaining that back to youthful a youthful expression.
Pretty profound.
I mean, I was in this seat that I had the time with him yesterday, and it was, you know, it takes your breath away because think of the implications of that long term.
Yeah.
But, you know, as we are here today, I think we have to be on the front end of all of these degenerative conditions. For example, as it relates to vision, whether it's glaucoma or macular degeneration, the big players that relate to our compromised vision, our failing vision as we age. And I think that prevention is really, you know, very important. We and we recognize that, again, inflammation is playing an important role, you know, as well as it relates to a macular degeneration, the ability of our bodies to create and utilize antioxidants and other things like zinc, for example, are very important. So everything that we can do to reduce inflammation is really so very important. And I would say that leading edge research now is interestingly focused on the powerful increase of inflammation that is created when our cells, and importantly, our immune cells, become senescent or old. When these cells of our immune system begin to get old and begin to fail, they want to let everybody around them know that they're getting old and they need some help. And what they do is they start to secrete these chemicals called cytokines that are inflammatory. So they're declining in their function, and at the same time, they're affecting cells throughout the body. And it's the senescence of these cells that we can target. We know that, you know, there's a lot of research being done on what is called senolytic therapy, helping our bodies get rid of these senescent cells and therefore reduce inflammation. So there's a lot of research being done looking at things like fisetin and quercetin. What is the role of intermittent fasting? How might time-restricted eating, for example, play into this in helping us rid our bodies of these senescent cells? And also what is called senomorphic therapy, whereby we don't necessarily get rid of those cells, but through what is called the mTOR pathway, we are able to reduce the inflammation, the downstream effects of the inflammation created by these cells that are aging in our bodies. So, you know, ultimately, while we don't have access to Dr. David Sinclair's findings right now, and it will probably be at least a decade or longer, nonetheless, what, you know, the balance of his work has been so instructive mm-hmm. in is that our lifestyle choices play a critical role in the activation of the genes to make our sirtuin enzymes, and how important our sirtuin enzymes are basically for our health and longevity.
Yeah, well said. And that mTOR pathway, for people that don't know, I mean, that's one of the ways that researchers are exploring how fasting and the ketogenic diet, because of moderating protein, the longevity benefits of fasting and the ketogenic diet in increasing lifespan. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, that's true. I would say that most of the data is animal data. Mm-hmm. Gee whiz, you know, a lot of the research has been done in yeast. In fact, as mentioned, Dr. Sinclair's work began with yeast, and you might say, well, why do I care? Well, because we have the same pathways, as fate would have it. You know, yeast and humans, 70% of the genes in yeast we share. It's hard to imagine that
yeah.
that part of their genome has been conserved for billions of years.
Yeah.
So these fundamental pathways have been conserved. And indeed, you know, we have a powerful controls over switching on the mTOR mm-hmm. pathway or switching it off, which, you know, is really how we cycle between building up and tearing down. And, you know, it turns out that we really have to recognize that tearing down is really important. We all want to build our muscles and build up our tissues, et cetera, but we have to break down as well, because when mm-hmm. we continue to build up, we ultimately can be building up things that are not necessarily good for us, not in good shape, that we have to get rid of things that are defective. Mm-hmm. And that when we're constantly in the growth phase, that might relate to abnormal growth, read cancer, what I just said. So that we have to understand how we switch then between breaking down, we call that autophagy, and building up, which is anabolism or an anabolic activity. And, you know, we have direct control over that switch. We can control that switch. Similarly, we can control a similar switch called AMP kinase that also regulates some very important pathways that deal with things like insulin sensitivity, that deal with things like inflammation, immune activation, immune competence, dealt with basically in this case, unlike the mTOR pathway, by how the AMP kinase pathway senses energy levels in our bodies, declining energy levels in our bodies sensed by the AMP kinase pathway. And then it turns on, it's activated, and that does some good things. Mm-hmm. That helps us with insulin sensitivity, helps us with reducing inflammation. Mm-hmm. But the point I make is that we can really exercise profound control over these pathways by looking at our diets, looking at exercise. Exercise is such a powerful tool to activate this AMP kinase.
Mm-hmm. So as you're talking, every time I talk to you, I feel this way, but your brain is a brilliant sponge of information. I'm curious to know, how many research journals, how many medical studies are you reading in a day? And how do you have a secret on how you're keeping all this information so readily available to communicate to people?
I can't give you a number in terms of how many research papers I read in a day, but it's a big number. And what I do is very old school. I also read a lot of books. I also print out a lot of these research studies. But what I do is very old school. It is, I use a highlighter pen. And what works for me is highlighting what's important and then reading it a second time. And then the second time I read things, reading the highlights, it all comes to life for me. And so, I told David Sinclair yesterday that, I don't know if you can see this, but
yeah,
that's what I do. I use a highlighter pen. I told him his is the first book that I burned two highlighter pens on. So
he's a good writer.
I guess it's some form of compliment.
Yeah, it is.
So that's what works for me.
I love it. So for people that are wanting to maybe read journals more or learn more about what's coming out, like exciting science and research, cutting edge research, what journals are exciting you the most lately? What are you reading more of?
That's a good question, and I have an answer for you. I'm really taken by, there's a series of journals that are frontiers in. frontiers in neuroscience, frontiers in various topics, frontiers in endocrinology, which I find very, very interesting these days for a number of reasons, and frontiers in immunology. So I've gravitated towards those. I like Cell, I like PNAS, BMJ, and of course, you know, the New England Journal and Lancet and JAMA, I think, just to see where the translation has taken to the application in the clinic and in terms of what mm-hmm. what clinicians then are going to be taking to the clinic and using. I find that to be very interesting. Mm-hmm. These days, since COVID started, we're seeing a lot of pre-publication stuff available to us before it's actually been peer-reviewed. And I'm loving that because you know, the peer review process traditionally has been something that has held up publications for quite some time. If things have not been peer reviewed, well, we have to understand that they've not, you know, that there may be some conflict of interest, there may be some methodological issues that challenge the conclusions, fine. But to be able to see a pre-reviewed study dealing with like the role, like one I read yesterday, it was published in last month, looked at the role of NAD, nicotine adenine dinucleotide, as playing a role in the bad outcome with COVID infection amongst mm-hmm. certain groups. We know that NAD goes down with age, it goes down, it is seen to be depressed in coronary artery disease, in type 2 diabetes, and in obesity as well. The factor, you know, we wonder what is it about those things that, you know, what's the mechanism here? And it looks like NAD is a strong player for that because NAD is, as I mentioned, very important for the action of the sirtuins and therefore our immune capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love it. I'm curious, this popped in my mind as well. I talked to you a few years ago about this when it happened, the day it happened actually, was the when you went on the CBS morning show.
and I talked to you that day?
Yeah, I was like, you had left the studio because we had an Instagram Live scheduled and anyways, as it was going down, we talked about it and we talked about it on social media too, I think, Instagram Live. In hindsight, in retrospect, what were your thoughts of that? And for people that don't know, maybe you can fill them in. I mean, they basically, you were on live television, you held it like a champ. You really did hold your own. But I mean, it was really cringy what they did to you, in my opinion.
Yes. So it was the 5-year anniversary of Grain Brain. And that was a book that talked about the idea that perhaps gluten is an issue in our health, and more importantly, mm-hmm. that sugar and refined carbohydrates may not be what we should be eating. Mm-hmm. At the time it came out, it raised a lot of eyebrows because at that point we were still deeply into, yeah, sugar's good, fat is bad, and all that. I think, to be fair, that time has kind of validated what our contentions were. Yeah. But nonetheless, these hosts of this program, you know, the whole mentality of television has changed, and they had me set up for, they just wanted to take me down. The first thing when Gail started the interview, she said, you know, this morning I had a jelly donut and et cetera. And I know I shouldn't, but you know, I can't imagine it's necessarily bad for me. And Dr. Perlmutter, we reached out to the sugar industry to get a comment about sugar and your book. And here's what they said. And they put it up. They made a graphic, which has been great for me because I've used that graphic aggressively in my lectures, that sugar is okay there in moderation, that there's no studies out there that indicate that eating sugar is bad. And what my response to that was, first of all, I paused. I said, well, how do you respond to that? Nora, I'm not sure of her last name, jumped on me. And before I answered, I took a clearing breath. And I don't know if they were ready for that. And I said, you know, where we are with sugar, or at least where we were a few years ago, is pretty much where we were when doctors were telling us that, and the tobacco industry was telling us that we should smoke cigarettes. And it hung in the air because I think I responded nicely. And brilliant. I tried to have, and they just kept going. Mm-hmm. They said a certain doctor, when Grain Brain first came out, said that it was a foolishness. And I said, yes, and how incredible it is that he is now using that, my book, Grain Brain, in his Alzheimer's prevention program at the particular Ivy League university that they had mentioned. But anyway, I was about to say, you know, coming on your program, I'm a guest in your home. And shouldn't we be kinder to the guests in our home? I didn't. I was thinking that, but I just decided I would simply respond to their questions. But it was a realization for me that television has degraded itself. And they know darn well that when they're attacking people, they'll attract listeners and viewers and then be able to sell their commercials, et cetera. That's how, you know, television is. It's sensational. It's aggressive. It's fear-inducing. And that's all right. I have... I had an experience like that one other time in my life where somebody had written a book about why gluten is great. We should eat more gluten. And just the week before that book was published, he wrote an article that's published in a very popular magazine saying how terrible Dr. Perlmutter is, what an awful person he is. And I was awful for every imaginable reason. And my wife is all, everybody is awful. And I sell supplements in my medical practice. Oh my gosh. Anyway,
wow.
So when that article came out, the very next morning, I got this kind of emergency conference call from my publisher, my literary agent, and my writer, all three on the phone with me. What are you going to do? Dr. Perlmutter, what are you going to do? And I said three words. I said, God bless him. Because I realized it's the best thing this guy could do is to reach out and attack me so that I would then engage. That'd be great for him. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that I can't let someone else define what I think of myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I work really hard. I try to do the best job that I can each day.
Yeah.
And somebody trying to sell a book is not in any way going to define me in terms of how, you know, what I do and how I feel about myself.
Yeah.
I make mistakes. I'm not perfect. My messaging has changed over time. That was the biggest criticism. That Dr. Perlmutter used to tell us never to eat eggs and that any dietary fat is bad. Did I ever say that? I did. I said that 25 years ago when that was the best information we had.
Right.
We've learned with time that that's not good information. I've changed my messaging. So I think that from... may I say, thought leaders, we should hope that they will change their outreach with time based upon current science. That's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, those are all good experiences. And
yeah.
I'm grateful for them.
Yeah, that's a great outlook. I love that. And anyone that knows you, you know, knows you're a man of integrity and an authentic human being. And it's interesting, if you're on a national show talking about, and they're trying to do gotcha journalism about why sugar is good for you, you know they're going to do gotcha journalism with everybody because what you were saying is not, should not be controversial at all, but they were making it controversial just for the sake of ratings.
And, you know, here it was probably a 6-minute segment and I didn't have the chance to go, you know, nor would I've even attempted to go through some of the literature talking about sugar and its role in raising blood sugar and its role in increasing body fat and therefore it being pro-inflammatory, exacerbating insulin resistance and any number of things, but changing the microbiome, increasing gut permeability. I mean, where do we stop the conversation? Nor would they have been able to, I think, get their arms around that. So, you know, it's all about sound bites and there you go. It's all good.
Yeah. What's on the horizon for you? What's next? Do you have another book in the works? Like, fill me in.
I do. And where I'm going to now is I'm doing a deep dive into fructose and specifically in a relationship that really hasn't received a lot of attention. That is a mechanism involving uric acid that is really fundamental in most of the damaging effects of a high fructose diet.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Do we know when it will be out or?
Not sure. But it'll be probably about a year from now.
Oh, I can't wait for that. I mean, you're right. There's so many, even natural products that I know you will explore. I'm certain you'll explore in the book that people think are healthy, but are high fructose that are really raising inflammation and specifically uric acid.
Yeah, and we've done we've already collected our literature base for this, and it is vast and aggressively supportive. So we're already well underway, and
good.
It's interesting, and you know, it does take me back to my biochemical kinds of interests from years ago, and in explaining how things work for people, and doing my best to explain it such a way that people can embrace it, mm-hmm. and then realize how important this is and how, you know, this one nuance of our diets has been so infiltrated and needs to be called out.
Yeah, well said. The podcast is called The Art of Being Well, and you are, like I mentioned, your brain is a sponge and you know so much information, and it's evolved, you mentioned, over the course of your career. But what do you know now that you wish you knew 20 years ago about the art of being well that's been very transformative in your life?
Well, I'd say you should floss your teeth more often. I think that we should be careful in terms of how much sun we get. I learned that. But I think it's important not to sweat the small stuff. Mm. That, you know, there's so much that goes on around us that to ruminate over small things that are not quite perfect in life is exceedingly destructive. I've also learned that we have within us incredibly powerful mechanisms that will keep us healthy for an awful long period of time. And what we now know that we didn't really know years ago is exactly how they work, and more importantly, how we can tap into those things. And we've talked about some of that stuff today. We've known for a long time that exercise is good, but I would submit that we really didn't know how it worked. We knew that people who exercise tend to live longer, tend to have less risk of various diseases, stronger bones, more robust immune systems, better glucose control, et cetera. But we didn't know the mechanisms. Now that we know the mechanisms, it really tends to reinforce lifestyle choices like exercise. We knew mm-hmm. nothing about sleep. We knew that if we didn't get a good night's sleep, we were cranky the next day. That was kind of it. And sleep was sort of an afterthought. It was sort of like lost time when we could have been doing something. We now value sleep at the level that it should be valued, recognizing that, you know, we don't spend 8 hours a day eating or exercising, but we should spend a third of our lives sleeping. Mm-hmm. And what an important tool it is to keeping ourselves healthy, to balancing our immune systems, and to allowing our brains to function optimally. So we've learned, you know, quite a bit about the mechanisms whereby lifestyle choices influence our health and longevity, and even our gene expression. So we've been able to tap into our life code. When years ago, certainly in medical school, there were two fundamentals that were inviolate. The first was that we have a fixed number of brain cells, and we would never get and we would never grow new brain cells. Well, we now know that's just isn't the way it is, that we have this process of neurogenesis going on in our throughout our entire lives. You know, people in their 90s are growing new brain cells. And even more importantly, we know how to augment that process. We know how to increase the growth of brain cells, for crying out loud. So that's something we've learned, I've learned, that's been, you know, powerfully influential. And the second thing is the notion that our life code, our DNA, is not locked in the glass case, that we influence moment to moment the expression of our DNA based upon choices that we make. We modulate, we change our epigenome moment to moment based on every one of our lifestyle choices, and some things that you might not consider to be lifestyle choices, like the news we watch or the TV programs we watch, or our levels of stress. These are actual choices that we make each day. Think about it. What we choose to pay attention to, be it the birds singing outside or the news on the television, it affects us, but it changes the expression of our life code. Mm. When you contextualize those experiences like that, it really makes you think twice about how you spend your day. And that's been a revelation for me, you know, in the past quarter century, that has really had an impact.
Yeah, beautifully articulated. Dr. Perlmutter, thank you so much for your time and being on the show today.
Dr. Cole, thank you for having me. Always good to see you. Say hello to everybody out there, and miss you guys.
Miss you too. If you want to learn more about Dr. Perlmutter's work, his amazing podcast, his books, you can check it all out at drperlmutter.com. That's drperlmutter.com. At the end of every episode, I'll be answering a question from one of you guys. Nothing is off limits. Ask me anything. And you can send your questions over to me on Instagram or Facebook. As a functional medicine practitioner, it's been fun seeing the questions that have come in on different food philosophies, wellness trends, and ways to approach overall mental, emotional, and physical health and well-being. Thanks for those. And I'm looking forward to seeing what else is on your mind. Let's get to today's Ask Me Anything. Today's question is from Taylor. Taylor asks, "Hi, Dr. Cole. What exactly is leptin resistance and how do I know if I have it?" Great question, Taylor. Leptin resistance, probably heard me talk about it on the podcast in past episodes in passing. Definitely I've talked about it on social media, on Instagram. I write about different health issues there. And obviously with my patients, I talk about it at length and I've written articles about it. Basically over the past decade, you probably heard me talk about leptin resistance from time to time. It is a hormonal resistance pattern. Leptin is a hormone that our fat cells produce, and leptin's supposed to tell the hypothalamic cells of the brain, the hypothalamus, to burn fat for fuel. It's a signaling molecule, just like any hormone is. It's that little biochemical email that's supposed to tell the hypothalamus, in this instance, to burn fat for fuel. And the fat cells are saying, use me for fuel, use me for fuel. But the brain isn't getting the message. The brain is kind of not reading it. So they're sort of deaf and blind to leptin's existence. So that's what leptin resistance is, this hormonal resistance pattern. So this can really drive a lot of weight loss resistance and other metabolic issues. And you could, you know, eat like a rabbit and not lose weight with leptin resistance. So it's definitely can be an underlying impediment for people that are struggling with losing weight. And you've tried working out and being really diligent with that, or going on diets and the weight just won't come off. Well, leptin resistance can be an underlying culprit and cause to that weight loss resistance, or that difficulty to losing weight. And it's also associated with other things as well. I deal clinically a lot with people with biotoxin issues, specifically mycotoxins or mold toxins, and people that are exposed to mold toxins, and that really impacts the brain signaling as well and can drive leptin resistance. So the context of leptin resistance has to be understood, because there's sort of two camps of people with leptin resistance. There's people that have metabolic syndrome and people that have insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is well researched in the scientific literature as being connected to leptin resistance. So when you look at A1C or your 3-month blood sugar average, you look at triglycerides and HDL and the ratio of the two, you look at your glucose levels, your fasting blood sugar. And there are many people that have metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, that also have high leptin, and that leptin resistance and insulin resistance are sort of intertwined and driving this metabolic issues. And that is, for these people, what's contributing to their weight loss resistance and other symptoms. And then there's another camp of people as well. There's people that with the mycotoxin, biotoxin issues, and they're exposed to mold and their blood sugar looks fine. Their A1C looks good. Their triglyceride HDL ratio looks fine. Like all of the traditional metabolic syndrome, insulin resistant patterns are fine for these people, but their leptin is through the roof. Oftentimes, and again, there's exceptions to what I'm saying here, but oftentimes people that under that category that have high leptin, but all the other insulin resistant markers look good, have mycotoxin issues. Their body has accumulated mold toxins, and that's what's driving up the leptin. So the mechanism and what's driving that high leptin has to be understood. And that's where a good solid health history, you hear me talk about comprehensive health history and being due diligent from a clinical standpoint, it's so important, because it can start to suss out even before you run labs, what are the things that could be at play here? And labs can substantiate that and we can get definitive answers on here. But definitely at that point, for the mycotoxin people, you'd want to run mycotoxin tests and these other immune mediated tests like TGF-beta1, C4A, C3A, MSH, these other tests. Because what's happening, and specifically with the mycotoxin people, is that the hypothalamus isn't speaking to the rest of the body. So you're going to see high leptin and you're also going to see low MSH, because the hypothalamus produces MSH, or alpha melanocyte stimulating hormone, and because of the mycotoxin, the mold toxin issues. And so the fat cells aren't able to communicate to the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus isn't able to communicate to the rest of the body, because in this instant, the amount of toxicity from the mold toxin is impacting that communication line. the other category of people, the more traditional pattern of high leptin resistance, you're typically going to find high triglyceride, low HDL, high inflammation markers like C-reactive protein, more traditional inflammation markers, I should say, and high glucose and a high A1C. Now, look, people can have both of those. It doesn't have to be either or. It can definitely be both and. Someone can have mycotoxin and insulin resistance. I'm just saying, there are two separate things going on here. And obviously, someone with mycotoxin issues can definitely drive more insulin resistance over time for some people as well. So how you know if you have leptin resistance is measuring serum leptin. It's a blood test. And we want it in the optimal zone for most people to be under 10. Higher leptin levels above 10, we have to start looking into why. Is it insulin resistance? Is it some sort of other mycotoxin or biotoxin issue? Or is there something else going on here? So we have to look at stress as well and how the person's sleeping. We have to look at the rest of their health history to understand what's going on here, because you can't just hang your hat on one number on the lab and say, well, this is what it is. We have to go upstream. Why? So that's what leptin resistance is. Hopefully answered your question. Thanks again for listening to The Art of Being Well. If you have a chance, please rate and review the podcast here. And if you like what you're hearing, hit follow and pass it along to a friend. To see more, head to drwillcole.com/podcast. I'll be back again next Thursday, and I hope you will too. Talk soon.